This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
Lead Singer Syndrome is brought to you by Rockabilia.com. With over 500,000 items and so many rare and unique pieces, Rockabilia is the best and biggest place for all your band merchandise needs. Check out Rockabilia.com today.
I'm sick with this, I'm sick with this. Since you wasn't the bottom, large judgment. My own sweet time didn't teach what I thought. I didn't recognize simple things anymore. I don't wanna be defeated, I don't wanna be defeated, I don't wanna be defeated, I don't wanna be defeated.
Oh, hey, everyone. Welcome back. I hope you survived your Thanksgiving craziness, Black Friday, Cyber Monday. Who can even keep track at this point? So much stuff going on. But welcome back to another episode of Lead Singer Syndrome. As always, I am your host, Shane Toll. I apologize. I've been a little under the weather. I've got this post-tour sickness thing that comes in. It's the weirdest thing. It's like it doesn't matter how many shows I play in a row, whatever. The second that I'm done with a tour, my voice just says, nope. You're done. It's like my brain knows I don't have any more shows, so my voice just says, nope, we're done. And so I apologize if I sound a little bit hoarse. But hey, welcome back. Great episode this week with Toby Duncan of Trash Boat. I don't know if you know Trash Boat. They're a newer band from the UK. What else? They're awesome, first of all. And they're a little different. I mean, a lot of people want to throw them in the pop-punk genre, and I don't really think it's quite as cliche pop-punk. But of course, at the end, I will play a song, and you can judge for yourself. Before we get into that, I hope you checked out the Rockabilia.com Black Friday and Cyber Monday sale. If you didn't, that's okay, because they're still there with over 500,000 different merch items, so much rare and unique stuff. Everything is 100% licensed from the band. There's no knockoffs. It isn't like Amazon, which unfortunately, there's a lot of knockoffs on Amazon. You got to really be careful. So again, go to rockabilia.com. They're a brand new sponsor of the show. They really, really are supporting what I'm doing, what the whole Jabberjaw Media Network is doing. It's really, really great to have them. So again, it's rockabilia.com. That's rockabilia.com. And of course, if you want to help out the show, it's real easy. The best way is to join the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club. For as little as $6 a month, it gets you in the door. You get bonus episodes, Q&A sessions with me, merchandise sent to your house every few months, interaction with me and other fans of the show on the Facebook group. It really is just a good time. And of course, it is what keeps this show going week after week. We've got so many upcoming guests that are incredible. So many great conversations. I cannot wait for you to hear them all. But hey, if you want to throw me a bone, you know, give me a little love. I really do appreciate it. So check out the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club. It is leadsingersyndrome.com/all-access. $6. What's $6 now? Can you even get like a Jimmy John's sandwich? I think a Jimmy John's sandwich is $6. But what can you even get for $6? And I'm just asking for that once a month just to keep the dang lights on. Again, leadsingersyndrome.com/all-access. Anyways, let's jump in to my conversation with Toby Duncan of Trash Boat.
Singer Syndrome, with your host.
Welcome.
I'm your host, Tobias Duncan. Today we discuss UK bands and how much shittier they all are than mine.
We could start there if you want. You really want to go there, we can do that. Most definitely.
I will talk shit for the next 45 minutes.
Is this a shit-talking session, Toby? Is that what we're doing?
You're recording already?
Yeah, fuck yeah, I'm recording. This is on the record. And you don't know where I'm going to start things. I could definitely start it.
Started things
right there
20 minutes ago while I was sleeping.
Sleepy guy. Well, we'll see. Maybe we'll leave that in. Maybe we won't. But hey. Toby, so good to have you, man.
Good to be
on yeah. Lead Singer Syndrome. Here we are.
Fuck yeah.
In Munich, Germany, on the last day of a tour, which has been pretty good, man. Have you had a good time?
We've had a very good time. Like, Europe is always, like, a great place to tour because they just take real good care of you. And you get, like, decent food and you get, like, a cooked meal every night. So you don't have to worry yeah. about, like, being fed and, like, going to McDonald's every night because you can't afford to eat anywhere else or some shit like that.
Totally.
Even though I go to McDonald's every day anyway.
All right. Well, I go there for the free Wi-Fi.
Right.
But then, like, yesterday morning, I got up kind of early and I had some work to do. So I went to the McDonald's and they were, like, they kept, like walking past me, like, giving me the stink eye.
Yeah.
Because I hadn't bought anything yet.
Get the hell out of here.
It's like, ah, fuck. And then I was like, wait a second, it's Germany. I can buy a veggie burger. This is great.
Do they do a veggie burger in Germany?
Yeah.
I keep looking at their menu. I know that in Belgium, McDonald's in Belgium, in fairness to them, go in. They've got like seitan chicken burgers, whole veggie range on the menu. Yeah. Germany, I haven't seen nothing. I normally go in.
Austria, they have a vegan McChicken.
Yeah, that's the same one in Belgium.
Yeah, yeah. It's like so good. And it's funny because I was reading an article like literally just the other day about how the McVegan is coming and they're like testing it in Finland or something.
Yep.
And everyone's like freaking out and I'm like, wait a second, like almost every country I feel has yeah. a vegan option at McDonald's except for America and Canada.
Yeah.
And I guess
America
the UK
sucks, but America has Taco Bell, so it's all good.
It does. Taco Bell's amazing.
Taco Bell's I literally survived on Taco Bell in the US. I had it every day.
We used to eat it. That used to be our thing when we were Silverstein was touring, like back in the van days. That's what we did too. And we would eat Taco Bell literally 2 to 3 times a day because it was the only way we could get by. Like, we used to per diem ourselves, and we didn't have any money or anything, but we would per diem ourselves $5 a day.
$5 is all you need in Taco Bell.
And that's all you need. You get a cup of water, and then you go and you just put Coke in it anyways.
Yeah.
Pepsi.
Standard.
Or Mountain Dew, Baja Blast.
I like Baja Blast, but the original Mountain Dew is just better. Okay. I end up getting diet because I end up just pussying out and not wanting sugar.
But you're a skinny guy. You can use a little sugar in your life.
It's
maybe.
My teeth.
You know? Oh yeah, does it fuck your teeth?
Sugar. Whenever I drink or eat something real sugar, because I have like a sweet tooth. I enjoy my sugar, so I try and limit it wherever I can because like there's just no enamel left on my teeth. Like I got my teeth are like not falling out, but they're sensitive. You know.
Well, it's funny you say that. Yeah, like for me too. When I was a kid, I used to drink a lot of sugary pop like all the time. We call it pop in Canada, and at some point, I don't remember. I remember I like woke up one time and I hadn't, like, it wasn't like morning, but I like hadn't eaten and I had like a full sugar, you know, full fat Coke, and my stomach like started like killing me, like really, really hurting. And ever since that moment, if pretty much I'd say most of the time I have a Coke, unless it's like way in the evening and I've eaten like a couple meals, it hurts my stomach. I guess it must be the sugar, because right now, as we speak, I have a Coke Zero here, and it's fine. I can drink this shit, like, all day in the morning, all day, I'm fine. So it's got to be the sugar, I guess.
Well, I fucking love sugar so much, I could just have full sugar Cokes, chocolate, sweets, all that kind of stuff. I could, and I want to, but I am a bit more strict with myself, because I feel like I should be. But, you know, I just, like, don't want to be, I don't know. Yeah. Like, when I was a kid, I just used to just chew ice lollies. I could just bite right into ice with my teeth, no worries. And now I drink, like, a cup of tepid water and my teeth just sting. So it must. And I brush twice a day. I take good care of my teeth. Famous last words. But I still just have really sensitive teeth. And it must be because of the sugar that I eat. So
who knows, man? But you're right. You're definitely right about Germany taking care of us, and it is great. In the UK, it's like, you know, we're playing pretty small rooms on this tour, relatively speaking. Like, you know, we're not playing massive halls like in Germany, like we typically do, where they really take care of you. But even though, like, tonight it's only 300 cap room, we're still going to get taken care of. Yeah. We still have a great dressing room, a shower, a full rider, a beautiful dinner. We have all that. The UK, you play 300 people, they're like, Who are you? Are you even supposed to be here? All right, whatever. There's a closet for you to put your shit in.
Yeah, straight
and
up.
Here's a half, like, here's 12 bottles of warm ass beer and go fuck yourself. Here's five quid, maybe.
We played a bit. It wasn't our show, it was a support show, but it was only us and one other band. But it was a big show at a big venue in Oxford. And in our dressing room, there was a pile of napkins, some plastic cutlery, and a big, like, thing of table salt. And that was it. Like, we had to ask for water, so we had just water and salt.
That's supporting or that's headlining?
That was supporting, but it was supporting, like, it was about 2,000, well, maybe a bit less, actually. Maybe 1,000, somewhere
between
1,000.
See, I put that on the headlining band, though. I mean, it's up to the headlining band. Like, they, a venue, any venue in the world, pretty much, that's got 2,000 people coming out, they've got something sorted with the catering budget, and that's up to them to throw you a bone.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, but
well,
hey.
Well, we sold out the Underworld and still got like a, we got like a rider, but it was like, you know,
yeah,
chips.
But Underworld's like what, like 500, I think. Yeah. And, you know, there is always obviously a big difference as you climb up the ladder. And speaking of climbing up the ladder, Trash Boat starting to pick up some heat.
We're doing okay.
A band that I, you know, I'll admit I heard of first because our drummer is your manager, and, you know, he's been our manager pretty much, well, since our band's inception. And so it's a really cool story, because I feel like you guys have gone just from, you know, a small band from the London suburbs to, you know, a band really starting to pick up some steam and doing some things, and all over the world for sure, but in the UK especially, now picking up some major heat. How's that feel?
I mean, like, it's great. Like, it's literally what I wanted to do with my life. Like, when I was a kid, it was the one thing I wanted to do, and now it's happening. Like, obviously, it's incredible, and like, you feel like there should be something a bit more tangible whenever you achieve your dreams. But you, like, it's great. Like, it's exactly what I want to be doing with my life right now.
What do you mean by tangible exactly? You mean like, well, money, you know, like money and
no,
riches
no, 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 no.
And,
like,
and treasure and gold?
No, like an actual, like that first time you took MDMA glow, you know, that feeling.
I've never taken MDMA.
No, you never had it.
I have right. not, but I've heard, you know, like, it's great stuff.
It's fake happiness, man. It's right there. I think maybe that's like soiled my that's now my frame of reference for like a good feeling. I'm not shitting all
wow.
over.
Wow. Isn't that a bit kind of like fucking terrible?
It's kind of sad, isn't it? Yeah. I've taken it like 3 or 4 times in my life, but whatever.
It's
like,
okay. I don't care. I don't care if you've taken it 300 or 400 yeah. times or 1,000 times. It doesn't matter
like,
at all. But
when you think about your dreams as a child, and you think like when you're like 15 and you're like, oh, all I want to do is be in a band. And I said this at Underworld when we were doing we have a thing called UCAS, which is like you fill out stuff and you pick your universities and like your A levels and what you want to do when you are thinking about going to university. And being the snot-nosed little kid that I was sat just like not really filling it out, not really paying attention, because I was thinking like, I just want to be in a band.
Yeah.
I just want to like tour. Yeah. And I said to my form tutor at the time and to my friends that if I could be in a band that sold out the Camden Underworld, I'd be happy. And we literally did that like a month ago. And I legitimately did say that, because that is like a forefront in my memory.
It's funny that you can even, like, at that point in your life, you even knew what, like, being in a band, selling out a room, like, even meant. Like,
yeah.
That's such an industry thing. Like, I was a kid going to shows and being a fan of a band, I never, like, sure, like, maybe I'd look around and be like, oh, like, there's a lot of people at the show, or, like, the show's kind of empty, but I didn't really care.
Yeah.
But for you to have that thought of, like, oh, yeah, like, that's, you know, a goal, it's kind of crazy. But let's go back to those days, because talk to me a little bit about, you know, your upbringing. Talk to me about where you grew up, like what your family structure was like. I know you speak of your family quite often in your lyrics and stuff. So
sure.
Talk to me a little bit about your family and your upbringing.
I had the most basic, vanilla, awesome upbringing ever. Youngest of three. My parents, they're just great. They're just really chill. My brother used to call me Golden Balls because he used to think that I got away with everything because he thought it was because I was the third child and that I just got away with everything because they couldn't be bothered. But I realized quite early, because my two older brothers are eccentric and they I don't know, like they used to like get in arguments and get in trouble with my parents a lot. And I kind of realized that if you're generally just like quite an agreeable child, if they ask you to do something, just do it. No questions, no arguments. It builds up like some brownie points, you know? So it means that if I want to do something stupid a little bit later, they're like, oh, it's okay, because he's normally quite good. And I kind of, because that was like the opposite of how my brothers acted.
Right.
I kind of figured that out. So I was just like really chill. If they were like, can you walk the dogs? I'd be like, yep, immediately. No questions. Like, can you do this for me? Can you do that? I'd be like, yep, yep, yep. And then when I like, if I got in trouble.
Bring on the MDMA.
Yeah. If I like wanted to go and party, or if I kind of fucked up at school or whatever, it, like I got in trouble for sure, but I was just like, they were just like, yeah, no, it's all good, because you're quite agreeable generally. And that's how I ended up getting away with doing a lot of stupid shit, and that's how I ended up talking my parents into not being hugely disappointed in me when I said I didn't want to go to university to study something quote unquote worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to try being in a punk rock band.
But when you were in school and stuff, like you say, you were kind of doing, you know, appeasing your parents and doing, following the rules,
mm-hmm.
Maybe getting a little bit of trouble, whether they were privy to that or not. Like, were you a good student in school? Did you get pretty good grades?
Yeah,
or was
yeah,
it
yeah.
pretty much you were just thinking about
I would
music?
Tell you what, I was a real good student in primary school. So up until the age of about like 11, 12, I was like, you know, fucking top of the class, paid attention, got really good grades and all that kind of stuff. I got like, we have a thing called an 11 plus, which is like, and you take your 11 plus, if you get a good score on the 11 plus, you go to a good school. If you get
okay.
a bad score, you go to, well, I'm not going to say a bad school, but like not the school of your choice. I got a great score. I went to the exact school that I wanted. And from then on, I just started to develop interests in things that weren't as academic as school. And just started to pay attention just a bit less. My grades didn't, I didn't fail anything. Like mm-hmm. I passed everything that I took, but I, you know, I just kind of.
So what were these things that were kind of like, you know?
I mean, my parents are so classic. They were just like, we want you to be a doctor or a lawyer. Like it sounds cliche, mm-hmm. but they were literally saying stuff like that. I was studying chemistry, maths and physics were probably like my strongest, even though I wasn't like a genius or like I didn't have like a particular aptitude. And I had applied to go to university to study, I think it was forensic chemistry.
Okay, and, wow.
At Birmingham, and I got accepted in Plymouth University as well. And I think there was one other that I went to see. But it was when I went down to Plymouth with my mum. And we walked around the uni and we went to look at the halls that I'd be living in and just to look at the university and look at the course. And it was like a 4.5 hour drive. And about an hour into looking around this university, I was just like, I just don't want to do this. I just don't want to be here. I don't want to study forensics yet. I want to try something else first. Because
yeah.
if I go to uni and if I study whatever, and then I come out of uni at 21, 22, and then decide to take a break and try something else, it, you know, it might be too late by that point. I'm like 18 now. If I'm going to do something stupid and like try and make it or whatever.
And by stupid, you mean music.
Yeah.
For all the people listening.
Straight
yes.
up.
Yes. So if you want to be stupid, try stupid. To do what we do. But okay. But like, so I'm just trying to get a picture of it. So during this whole time when you were in high school, you were playing in bands, like what yeah. was going on?
I was playing in real shitty bands. I was in a lot of metal bands because like, my brother.
And you were singing or are you playing, like were you playing instrument or anything?
I played guitar. I wasn't good enough at guitar to be in the kind of band that I was in at the time. So I started out playing guitar because my oldest brother got me into music. He's like the reason why I listen to the music that I do. And, you know, he always used to listen to, like, Metallica, Rage Against the Machine, Pantera. So
yeah.
I got started at quite an early age with that. Started playing guitar because he was playing guitar. I actually tried to play drums first, but that was very short-lived because I realized that I didn't have rhythm or I didn't stick at it long enough to get it. I just gave up drums
okay,
quite quickly
sure. yeah.
and then went to guitar. And then being a teenager, I was joining a bunch of metal bands, a bunch of hardcore bands. All of them sucked, but at the same time, they were great. You know, they were a lot of great fun. And then I started screaming in some metal bands. This is about age 17-ish. None of these bands like recorded anything substantial or played any like shows that were worthwhile. And then I played guitar in like an easycore band and sang backup.
What's easycore?
Like Meebo.
Forgive my ignorance. No, I really don't know. It's like what easy core is.
Pop punk with like breakdowns. So like Chunk No Captain Chunk or Meebo's Hero or Kid Liberty.
Okay.
Old in her own words. Stuff like that. A Day to Remember could be considered easy core.
Okay. Okay. Good to know. I learned something today.
Yeah, right. And then I was singing backup in that, and I'd always had like, I knew I could sing like a little bit, but I never really considered singing as like a thing that I would do. And then that band kind of caved in. I joined an emo band playing guitar, and we uploaded like a cover of a song, just like a really crappy acoustic cover, just to our Facebook page when we first started out. And that's where Ryan found me and sent me a message being like, look, our band's just broken up. We need a new singer. Do you want to come and sing? And I was like, yeah, because I had nothing else going.
And how old were you at this point?
Ooh, must have been about, I think, 20.
So you were already past this conversation. You went to Plymouth and everything.
Yeah. So
when you were, but this is what's interesting to me. So when you were, you talk about you were in these bad metal bands, yep, and they weren't really going anywhere, but you still had some sort of insight when you were a teenager about to go to uni. Like, you still had some insight that like that was what you wanted to do.
Absolutely.
So what were you doing between when you told your mom, like, sorry, mom, I'm not going to do this. Sorry, mom.
It was a sorry mom moment.
I can believe I can relate to this too.
Yeah.
My story is very, very similar to yours, actually. Yeah. But I'm kind of trying to put together this timeline of like, it's like at that point when you're like, sorry, mom, you're at Plymouth and you're like, I don't want to do this. Did you have anything going on?
Absolutely.
Because Trashboat didn't come till later.
Yeah, no, Trashboat was about like 2 or 3 years off.
Which is crazy to me. So like that you had still had the insight to be like, okay, I want to do this, even though you hadn't had any glimmer of success.
Or really,
by your own admission, any talent, really.
No, I hadn't even really played a show that was bigger than like a pub show at that point.
Yeah, that's like really crazy. Because a lot of times you hear about those people that are like, I knew I was going to make it. You know what I mean? There are people, but you kind of are like that. Because threw away some easy roads for a very unknown road.
I knew I wanted to try. That was my big thing. Like, because after school, when I had the sorry mum moment, and she was, you know, she was like, oh, I wanted to, you know, be able to introduce you as Dr. Duncan. I was just saying,
oh, boy.
Yeah, I'll do it. This goes back to me saying that, you know, building up brownie points and all that kind of stuff. Like, I've always been quite sure of myself, and I was sure of myself to the point where I successfully convinced my mum that I wasn't just throwing my life away, that I was going to give this like a real shot.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't like having arguments with her, just being like, this is all I want to do, this is all I ever want to do. I was like, look, realistically, if I'm going to try and be in a band, I need to make some kind of wave before I'm pushing 30. So I was like, look, if I get to like 27, 28, and I still haven't really been in any kind of project that's done anything, you have my word that I will pursue something different, because clearly it's not worth it. If it's been like 10 years and it's not going for it, which could be said to be a silly thing to say, because I didn't rush. They were like a bar band for like 20 years before they got discovered. But whatever. That's what I told her. And she was like, look, that's fine. Just do your thing for a bit. So when I came out of school, I just worked. I got a job. Well, I worked at a hotel that was like just up the road from my house for a bit. And then I worked just in customer care for a fashion company called ASOS, just like answering emails and stuff. But the whole time I was looking for bands, looking for projects.
What about this whole driving other bands around thing? Because I understand that's even when we're right now, for people to get perspective, we're hanging out on our European bus, which is kind of like it's a Mercedes-Benz. Like, I don't even know how you describe it. It's like a very, very, very big van.
It's like a bandwagon, I think we call it.
It's kind of like a bandwagon. Yeah. It's maybe not quite the same size for anyone that even knows what a bandwagon is.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's not really like, definitely everyone in the music industry knows what a bandwagon is, but I don't know if regular people do, but it's basically like a big, kind of looks like a milk truck.
Yeah.
But, you know, we came on here and there was some guy being like asking us, and you're like, oh yeah, like I, you know, kind of want to get one of these. And I was like, oh, right. Because you used to drive bands around.
Mm-hmm.
Was that something that you've done recently, or was that something you still do it?
I still do it, yeah, yeah. Well, when I worked for ASOS, it was night work. So I worked from 8 p.m. until 7 a.m.
Okay.
So it was 11 hours overnight.
That's pretty intense.
Which kind of sucked in the winter because I didn't get to see the sun. But, and like my social life, like I'm not like a big go out, drop hundreds on booze and spend loads. I never really spent any money on clothes. I'm not a big spender. Like, you know, I'm sat here in Nike tracksuit that somebody left in the van after I drove them that I've just commandeered, a t-shirt.
So that's why you drive vans, for the free clothing.
Dude, the amount of free stuff I've got that people... And the thing is, every time people leave shit in the van, I'm like, oh, you guys left shit in the van, do you want it? And they're like, dude, don't worry about it. So I'm just like, free, it's mine. I think these socks Sophie gave me because she found them in her suitcase, so I've taken these socks. This t-shirt is something a friend designed, they gave me for free. And the only thing I'm wearing that I've paid for right now is these sliders, which I would pay for again because they were...
The Adidas flip-flops?
Look at those Tripoloskis right there. They're so comfortable.
Thongs, feel as some people may call them.
Feel that. Oh. That is like the most comfortable thing ever.
Ooh, that is nice.
It rules.
That's nice.
But yeah, so I was working nights and I wasn't dropping loads of money on a social life. I wasn't like living it up. I was living really stringently. I still hung out with my friends, but it was all real chill. And I saved probably like 80% of my paycheck every month. Just put it away, put it to the side. So I was paying for food, and just living in general.
Mm-hmm.
And then after about a year and a half, 2 years of ASOS, and about halfway through working at ASOS, I joined Trashboat.
Okay.
And we hadn't like done anything, but we were practicing and we were writing yep. songs and it was kind of getting there. And we started to play shows and it was more shows than I'd ever played before. And I had all this money. I had about like £15,000 saved up, so that was like a good chunk. And I was like, right, if I am just gonna take this band seriously, and if I'm gonna have the time, because like every time I asked for a day off to play a show or some holiday, like I'd used up all my holiday and I was arguing.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was like, right, I need a job where I work for me, I can pick it up and drop
Smart.
It at any moment,
yeah.
and I can, like, you know, not be held back. So I bought a van.
You bought a splitter.
Bought a splitter, got it converted, and I started driving other bands because I'd played a few shows, I'd met a few other bands. I was like, you know me, I'm in another band, I can give you like a good rate. It keeps me connected to the scene.
Yeah.
And it's worked so far. I haven't made any money. It's not like, it's not the shit. Like, I haven't hit a gold mine with it. I haven't really lost money. I've kind of just kept myself level, which is fine.
Yeah, you probably pay for your van and
yeah.
some of your, you know, stuff like that. And you've driven some like pretty notable bands, right?
Yeah. I can't really say I've driven the Wonder Years have been in my van. I did merch for the Wonder Years and I drove them around. So like, they weren't paying me, but they were paying someone with a splitter and they were saying like, dude, next time we come over, we're gonna hire you. So I'll say I've driven the Wonder Years just because it's cool. But Moose Bloods,
yeah, they're
back in the
pretty
day.
Massive in the UK now.
Yeah, yeah,
they won't
right.
be needing your services anymore, unfortunately.
Who else can I think of? Dead are good friends of mine. Of course, I've driven my band around a lot. I normally just do like tours for like people that I like. I either know or managers
yeah,
that I know
sure,
that
sure,
have
sure,
bands
sure.
that need driving.
No, that's cool, and I guess that's something you still do. Like, do you find being in a band that's touring all the time, and you guys have done, you know, US tours, and you're in Europe and the UK, and you guys went to Australia too, didn't you?
We've just come back from Australia.
And so, you know, being all over the world, are you still going to feel like okay with yourself being like, all right, I just got back from this tour. Like, you even just said to me as we were walking out here, like, I'm very ready to go home. Is it going to be like, all right, that your kind of second job is like, I'm back in the van, I'm on tour, I'm driving people around, like, or is that going to be something you're maybe going to stop doing?
See, I love it because I just like the detachment. Like,
yeah.
I like having like a home base for sure. And I am the kind of guy that's liable to just, you know, hunker down and chill. But that could be considered a problem because I could just chill a bit too much. So I like the fact that my job and my hobby pulls me away from home for like 9 months out of the year, because it makes me appreciate the time I get at home more. And then whenever I start feeling myself kind of slipping back into like a bit too much of a chill mode, it makes me appreciate going back out on tour. So I've got like a really good balance going
cool.
on right now.
No, that sounds
and
great.
I'm enjoying it.
And you speak of the Wonder Years. I know my very good friend Soupy is also your very good friend, a great dude and
good guy.
Had a big role in your first record as the producer and kind of a mentor. That must have been kind of crazy. Like, talk about going from not like being a kid that didn't want to go to school playing in shitty metal bands to getting picked up by Trash Boat. All of a sudden, Hopeless Records is calling, and the singer of Wonder Years is producing your first record. That's what a journey have in such a short time. Well, run me through how that all kind of happened.
Metal was my first love. Like, metal is where my music taste originated, and I was that 14-year-old kid that was YouTubing top 10 heaviest beatdowns so I could find the next absolute heaviest band. That was how I found like a lot of my music, which is sad to admit, but they found me some sick
bands.
Hey man,
so I like
don't
heavy
care.
Music, obviously.
And you know, from there, I found a day to remember when my first like toe in the water in terms of pop punk goes.
Sure.
And then I discovered
easy core, if you will.
Easy core.
Yes.
I kind of discovered from there that like, you know, I like a tight melody. Like, I like pop punk as well. Mm-hmm. Started listening to a bunch of pop punk bands. Got really, really like super duper into A Day to Remember, 4 Years Strong, the Wonder Years, like in particular, were very unanimously liked amongst my friends at the time. They were like, you know, if we couldn't find anything to put on the Wonder Years, Polar Bear Club, Title Fight.
Nice, yeah.
Like, just, I like pop punk a lot, and I like, you know, was expanding my music taste the whole time. And so joined Trash Boat, played our first few shows, played more shows. Eventually, after about a year, got the offer from Hopeless, released that EP.
So how did that happen? You sent them a demo? Or like, no, I wonder how the hell bands even get signed anymore. And I know a lot of listeners are aspiring musicians, and they're wondering like, well, maybe my band's pretty good. I want to get on Hopeless. Like, what did you guys do?
They just got in touch with us. I like, if I were to guess, it would be that obviously Neck Deep had just recently blown up. There was a big old spotlight on UK bands, mm-hmm. and they must have just decided that we stood out in some
so you
way.
Had a little bit of heat going on the internet on, you know, your...
We weren't playing shows where people were like legitimately coming.
Well, not shows, but I mean just like on the internet. Like,
yeah, like we have like an engaging live performance. Like, I like to kind of leave it all on the stage. I put mm-hmm. as much energy as I physically can in, and we must have just, you know, someone must have just suggested it. I don't know. We just got that email one day and we were just like, yeah.
And that was the only label that contacted you guys? You didn't have a million offers like you hear about sometimes?
I don't think we got a million offers. I think once we got the offer from Hopeless, or once the word got out that we got the offer from Hopeless, I think there probably would have been like a few other offers floating around. But we ended up choosing Hopeless.
Cool. Great label.
Good label. Good dudes.
So then I guess that was the easy connection with the Wonder Years, because obviously the Wonder Years have been on Hopeless since they're, you know, they got discovered like you guys did.
Yeah.
Obviously now they're one of the, you know, biggest forces in pop punk.
For sure.
And how did that happen with Soupy? Did you guys ask about it? Did they suggest it? Did he ask about it?
It was kind of a combination of all of them. Like, yeah. we were just about to start writing our first album, and like Hopeless told us that Soupy was interested in producing for a band, and mm-hmm. there was just like emails back and forth just being like, if he were interested, would you be interested? And I'm sure they were like, if they were interested, would you be interested? And we were just like, yeah, fuck yeah. Like, absolutely. That sounds like something that would really help us. We knew that having an outside opinion of that caliber would help us to like write the best album that we could. And we got hooked up like over Facebook. And it started with like, we had a handful of songs written, and we'd just send the songs to him, and I'd just be like, I was thinking about putting this melody here, and he may be like, yeah, that's cool, maybe you could like just drop that first note and then like have a little build up there, and I'd be like, oh, yes. And we were just bouncing ideas off each other like that. And then a week before we recorded the album, he came over and he stayed with us, and we did pre-production every day in the Pioneer in St. Albans, where we set up like a full band thing. We played all the songs all together, and then we just were just like, oh, we should put like a fill here, or maybe we could like change this chord sequence, just like minor changes mm-hmm. like that. And then he came to the studio with us for the first week while I did vocals, and was just there helping me, like making sure I was recording the best vocals I could, making sure I was performing properly, and just or stuff like that.
Was it weird for you, like, having a guy that, you know, you talk about as a kid listening to their records, you're like, oh, I don't know, we don't know what else to put on, let's put on the Wonder Years because everyone likes this band's sick. Was it weird being like, this is my first record and this guy is listening to my, not just like I'm trying to like let all these listeners that are listening to this like understand what it's like when you're in a booth alone and you have this microphone and literally like everyone can hear every subtle nuance and breath, and like if you have something in your fucking teeth, they can hear it the monitor speakers. And to have a big influence of yours and a guy that you look up to literally critiquing you, that must have been, was that hard like for you to how did you, was it just that something that took a while to get over, to be like, hey, I have to perform and this is my record too, not just I'm singing in front of my, you know, idol kind of. Have been really weird.
I loved every second of it because I would like from the moment it was suggested, my first thought was, hell yes, I need to absorb some skills from this guy. This guy has been doing it for however long. He's released consistently good material that I've enjoyed. He's an incredible vocalist. I am not an incredible vocalist. And he could, like, help me.
Yeah.
He could help me, like, be better than I am. And he did. And, I've only been getting better. Like, I'm the best I have ever been now. And it's because being on tour and playing this many shows is the discipline that I don't have at home, to sing every day and practice singing every day and, like, figure out new things about my voice that I couldn't do before, that I, like, different ways to breathe and different ways to push it. And, like, I should do that at home every day, but I don't because I want to chill. But it was on the Newfound tour, because we played, like, nearly 50 shows.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that tour for sure, but go ahead.
And I was, like, singing almost every day, and like playing around with my voice and like really trying to get like a bit more grit and trying to do like more of a shout. And when we recorded the first album, like I couldn't shout at all. Like all the shouts on the first album is me trying to shout and not knowing how. And now I know how. So I'm stoked to record the next record because now I can like shout properly.
I think there's something to be said for performing live being so much different than performing in a studio and performing, you know, in a practice space. There's something about when you're there and something will come over you and it's like there's an adrenaline, and like I'll come out and I'll just be like yelling at the crowd, and I'm not a particularly loud yelling kind of guy, but I get in that environment and all of a sudden this comes out of me. And it's the same way when you're like on stage. I think some of my best screaming I've ever done is on stage.
Oh, I sound so much better.
What is up with
than
that?
I do in the studio. I freeze up in the studio, I guess.
Or I don't know what it is. It's just like the environment isn't, you don't have the same passion. But I will say this, when you're doing it live and all of a sudden it kind of comes out of you and you're like, oh shit, that's it. You do learn to harness that a little bit.
For sure.
And I think that that's probably why now your ability is improving, because you're understanding that it's not just, it's a physical thing. But you need a certain emotional level to capture it, if that makes any sense.
It's the volume. It's like, it's the intensity of it. Like, if I am singing at home and I turn everything up like way too loud so I can barely hear myself, I feel like I'm singing better. And like,
yeah,
when I jump on stage and I can like move around, because like when I sing, I sing with like my body, if that sounds really weird. Like,
no, so I totally understand.
If
what
I'm
you
doing
mean.
Like a big note, so if I'm going to go for like a high note, like I bring my arms in, I like tense up and I'm like,
yeah,
I can feel it. I can feel it everywhere. And when you're in the studio, you're kind of stood real still and like you've got your hands on the earphones and you're trying to like get your mouth in front of the mic and you're kind of, I'm just stood so still and it feels static. I feel static. And then I feel like my vocals are a bit more static. Like, yeah. I get it good, but and obviously it's not, you can't treat recording like a show. Like I couldn't hold the mic and cup the mic and like run around and like scream, because there would be, it wouldn't sound consistent.
I've heard of guys recording in studios with holding a mic.
I would love to, like my band would chastising me because I said I wanted to hold the mic the next, and they were like, "Nah, it's going to be a really inconsistent recording. No one does that. You're literally an
people
idiot."
People do that.
And literally,
it's not
Jordan from Newfound Glory came in the room as we were having the argument, and he was like, "Yeah, I held the mic," and I was like,
"No, I will say I actually don't. I don't hold the mic. I use, well, if I use a, you know, an SM7, you know, the mic. I think I see a picture of you with one, in front of one maybe, But you know, like the black long Shure mic, like everybody uses it. It's a great mic, and it's only like $350. This is not an ad for Shure. However, if Shure wants to sponsor the podcast,
I'm right here.
You're speaking into a Shure right now, Mike.
Oh, good that's a beta 58
actually. So, and new his moment. Voice sounds great, doesn't it? Okay, sure, great mics. Anyways, when I do, when I record, if I use that mic, I do actually hold the mic.
Yeah.
I don't, it's on a stand, but I like kind of brace myself around it.
I need to engage my, it's so weird how like my arms are tied to my voice.
Yeah.
Like I need to be able to engage my arms to sing.
But no, I've heard a lot of people, like some famous people, like maybe Jordan too, I've just literally, they hold an SM58. And that's what they record.
He said he held the mic for like the last however many records, and I was just like, yes.
And like my favorite one was Lemmy. The producer we worked with a few of our records also did all the Motorhead records.
Cool.
And Lemmy, if you ever watch a video of Motorhead, he stands there and he looks up.
Yeah.
And the mic comes down into his mouth, and it's an SM57 that he uses, like a mic you put on a guitar cab or a snare drum. And in the studio, literally, he stands there. He doesn't have a bass on, but he stands there and he sings upwards into the mic in the fucking studio.
So G.
Incredible.
So G.
So anyone that wants to tell you there's a rule about how to do it, there's no rules, man.
Yeah.
There's no rules. And I think Lemmy probably does that for the same reason that we're talking about. You're trying to harness an energy that you've acquired or you've witnessed in a live environment into a studio.
For sure.
Because that's what rock music is. Rock music doesn't exist because of the fucking studio. It exists because people would pour into this little club and you would fucking go crazy.
Yeah.
That's where screaming came from.
Like, I definitely, like, with the last album, because Supes was only there for a week, so we had to do the vocals while he was there, really. So that means I did vocals every day, wake up at 9 a.m., start vocals by 10:30 in the morning. That can't run for me.
What? I couldn't fucking do that.
I'm saying, like,
10:30 in the morning isn't happening,
I was waking up, crack of dawn, necking like a big old fat mug of like lemon and ginger tea, really just trying to warm up my voice in an hour.
Yeah.
In what I would normally need about 12 hours, like a whole day to warm it up. Because normally I don't like singing before like 4 p.m. If we have like an acoustic session that's like midday, I'm like, oh, it's going to just sound crap.
Sure. Or like if there's a festival slot that's earlier, it's always a pain in the ass. You got to get up early and try like, it's the worst.
And
I'm with you.
And I begin, and it was like December, January, so it was cold.
Yeah.
And I'd do like however many takes, do like a whole song, and then like it'd be 2 p.m. we'd go for lunch and I'd have like another whole song to do, and my voice would just be like fully worn out. I think we got some good stuff, but I was definitely leaving the studio feeling that it wasn't as consistent as I'd like.
Right.
With the next record, we've already been in discussions with producers as to how I would like to record the vocals. Definitely has got to be just like in the evening, whether we do like guitars first or whatever. Like, mm-hmm. I've got to like have my voice at my best for this one.
I mean, and like, this is Lead Singer Syndrome podcast, so we typically talk about how hard our lives are. but you know, let's be honest, people aren't really listening to the fucking, you know, bass as much as they're listening to the vocals, and it's important. And I always, like, with our records, like typically we'll do record guitars in the morning, and then after we've done guitars for a couple days, we'll start doing the vocals. Even when not all the guitars on the record, like we'll do the guitars on a few songs and then do the vocals in the afternoons or the evenings. And also, that gives you as a singer a lot. It's a lot less stressful on you, because then you're not like worrying about doing it all in the last week.
Yeah,
that's what happens if it's like, okay, we've done drums, guitars, bass. All right, you've got like, hey man, you've got 10 days to do vocals. It's plenty of time. Well, what happens if like I'm burnt out or I'm worn out?
I got burnt out like almost every
You lose
day.
Your voice. Yeah. And then what? You're fucked. Like for us, like the last record we did, the Silverstein, the Dead Reflection record, we weren't recording on Sundays and we weren't really recording on Saturdays. So Fridays, and if we did record on Saturdays, was all screaming.
Mm.
So I could fucking go as hard as I wanted on Friday, and I know I'd have time to rest.
Screaming, weirdly enough, is like the best warm up for me.
That's very weird.
That's like I always do like just a few minutes of solid screaming because it seems to just like, I don't know, it does something that makes me sing just like clear. Like maybe it's just clearer by comparison.
Well, your voice, I would say, has been changing from record to record.
Absolutely.
I'd say
it's been,
like
it's been changing from tour to tour.
It's kind of amazing, and I think, I mean, that's cool, and I totally welcome that change. But I'm sure, like, as a person that's trying to form a career with a band that has fans, you don't want someone to hear the new Trash Boat song or whatever it is along the road and be like, doesn't sound like Trash Boat. What happened? Is there a fear of that, that you're not developing a sound because your voice is constantly changing?
I mean, I don't think it's changed to the point where it like sounds different. It just sounds like, it sounds like I can do what I've already been trying to do. So I'm not doing anything different. I'm just doing things that I didn't know how to do and was just trying because I was trying to emulate other vocalists. But now I've got technique. I've got better technique and I can do it properly and more consistently, and it sounds like more real. It doesn't sound like I'm trying to just force something that I don't quite know how to do. And like, you know, that's me being quite hard on myself, and I'm sure a lot of people who listen to the record would be like, no, I mean, it sounds good. It sounds good, but now that I am performing the way that I'm performing and I listen back to the old record and I'm just like, it just sounds like baby steps for me, which is great because I'm confident that the next album is going to sound like more me, more real, more refined.
Well, the next record, and I know you're already working on it because you played me a couple things and we had some discussion about lyric writing and everything. It's a big record for you guys.
It's got
to
be.
Are you aware of that? Because whenever I speak to a band that's on their first record, I had Knocked Loose on here, and over the couple of years I've done this, I've spoken to people that have done their first record and it had success, and now it's like time for record number two. And I don't care who you are, everyone knows there's a lot of pressure on that record because I cannot think of a band, and if you can, I'd love for you to let me know, a band that has had an unsuccessful second record or fucked up their second record and has come back to have a successful career. Because I cannot think of a single band. There may not even be one. So that's just the way it is, and there's a lot of pressure, you know.
I think of bands that have fucked up their second record and
faded away?
Yeah.
Like who?
Oh, I'm not going to talk shit.
Why not? It's not shit talking. It's just true. It's not shit talking. We already started this with all the shit bands.
You know
UK
what?
Bands are
I can't
shit
even
talk.
Shit talk because it's not their second album. It was their third album. But it was Set Your Goals.
Right.
Set Your Goals had
Mutiny. I guess Mutiny was their second record, wasn't it?
No, Mutiny was their
Mutiny
first
was their
record.
First record.
And then they had, why can't I remember the name of that record? That's going to drive me insane.
It's okay,
but
we'll edit
the
this.
The third record. Was
we'll edit this so you seem
the third,
smart.
The third.
Okay, we won't edit
this,
it.
This will be the death of us. This will be the death
all
of
right.
us.
All right. This will be the death of us.
This will be the, and that was
I'm not editing this.
That was an absolute shining glory of a record, and then Burning at Both Ends was their third
right.
record.
I think, I mean, every situation is different with every band, and, you know, I don't necessarily think that that was what happened with Set Your Goals, where they went away, and I'm very good friends with all those guys.
Yeah, I love that band.
They're
well.
An amazing
like,
band.
I'm not talking shit.
An amazing band, and they're back, and they're doing some stuff again.
I can't wait.
I think, like, there was probably, it was more about issues with like within the personnel of the band than it was about the music. But, you know, the classic ones are like, for me, the classic second record is Finch. Mm. You know, which actually, when I go back and listen to that record, what is it called? Sunshine, Say Hello to Sunshine, is that it?
I'm
bad at titles. You know, that's a record that like definitely didn't pop up like off like What It Is to Burn, and the band was never the same. Mm. You know, there's a lot of bands that have had that happen to them. I mean, even my very good friends in Story of the Year, you know, they had a huge first record and their second record never did what, you know, and then, you know, the band lost, you know, they still had a great career and they're still doing stuff too, but you have bands that they never recover from not following up their first record. Mm. And do you feel that pressure? I mean, obviously, you're already thinking about it. Do you have plans to record the record? Is there studio time slotted?
Not necessarily slotted. We're still discussing producers and studios. Uh-huh. We have, like, but it's not like we don't know what we're going to do. Like, we have, like, a few options. We just need to pick one. For sure, I'm feeling the pressure, but, like, I was also feeling, like, you know, I was having these same discussions with people when we were writing our first record, and people were saying, like, this is your first record. You've got to make your mark. You've got to, like, you've got to, like, make an impression, and, you know, this is your first record. It's important. Are you feeling the pressure? And I'd be like, yeah, I'm feeling the pressure. So I'm feeling the pressure with the second record as well. But I'm more confident about this one because I'm just a better singer now. So, like, sure. I feel less nervous about making something that's going to sound good. The only thing I'm slightly nervous about, I guess, is that, my lyrical style is quite, like, introspective. It's quite, like, self-deprecating to an extent. And, like, life recently has been going, like, kind of well. Like, I haven't really got that many complaints.
Right.
So I'm, like, struggling to, like, find some things to be sad about. So I guess I could start writing really posy pop punk, but that's probably just not going to go. I've got like, 5 or 6 decent topics, but I need something to really upset me so I have something cool to write about.
It's such a great conversation about that kind of stuff. I think for me, too, when I wrote my first record, I was young. And I had a lot of, like, angst and teenage angst and heartbreak and lack of understanding of what I was feeling or what I was going through, which I think was very relatable to people. And that's why they kind of understood my lyrics. And then you're right, as things go on, it starts becoming more retrospective because you become smarter, you become understanding. And it's like, I was still writing about the shit that happened to me on the first record, on the fourth record, just in a different way.
Yeah.
And in some ways, that was better. But I will say that until our last record, when I really went through a hard time, it was hard for me to find that inspiration.
Yeah.
And as much as, like, I don't want to admit it, I really do think some of the best lyrics do come out of a terrible situation.
Yeah. Like, and the thing is, it's not because I'm trying to, like, glorify a terrible situation. It's because it's, like, a cathartic release for that terrible situation. And
totally.
It's just poetic, isn't it? Like, you know, like, you can write...
As poetic as nothing I write can change what you've been through.
Oh, nothing I write you can change what you've been through. Got to get the rhyme in there.
I said it, didn't I? Nothing I write you.
Oh, you said nothing I write. You didn't get the you.
Nothing I write you
can change what you've been through.
So it's supposed to be a little. There's supposed to be a comma. Nothing I write you can change what you've been through.
I don't know.
Think of the rhyme.
Is there a comma there? I don't know.
Nothing I write you can change. Well, anyways, let's talk. it's very, a very interesting title, especially for a debut record.
For sure.
Like, you know, a lot of bands wouldn't go to such a, I don't know, like, it's not really a catchy title. Like, Trash Boat comes out with this record, like, I don't know, what's a badass, like Empire, or,
what was I going to call it? There was a couple of ideas that I had. I was going to call it Cautiously Optimistic, because I feel like that's how I feel
or
most.
Caution would be a good record.
Yeah.
Cautiously Optimistic.
I didn't think that rung well as an album title.
It does. No, this is somehow better.
Yeah. What else is going to be? I think Soupy suggested Putting On War Paint, which kind of has, like, it punches, but I didn't really feel like that.
Putting
On War Paint.
War Paint would be a decent record for a record.
Yeah.
But no, I will say this about the title. Nothing I Write You can change what you've been through.
Mm-hmm.
I got it written down, so I'm good. it does make it very personal. It's words that you're saying to somebody, and right away when someone hears that, they're going, like, oh, he's, like, speaking directly to me. And I think that that is very reflective of the types of words that you write.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
For
you really are trying to put yourself out there in that way. Like, this is my experience, and this is something I'm sharing.
For sure. Like, personal experience is an important part of the writing for me because it helps me. But what I try to do while I write as well is leave a lot of the themes expressed around this personal experience quite open-ended so that people can apply their own experiences and find some kind of, you know, like, cathartic release by, like, embracing it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm writing about things that are very personal to me, and that, you know, people have asked me in interviews what, like, some songs are about, and there are some songs that I'm happy to just go into the absolute detail, and some songs that you know, I'm just like, yeah, I'm, you know, it's about this, but I'm not gonna discuss it, because it's not just about me. Like, it's about people, like in my family or people that I know, who probably wouldn't feel fully comfortable about me discussing what they're all about.
Right, right.
But leaving it a little bit more cryptic like that means that people can apply their own
sure.
experiences to it, which is very helpful for them and for me.
No, totally. But like with the, you know, the classic, and I hate to say classic because I shouldn't downplay this because it's real life and real feelings, but you know, people coming to you and saying, you know, your lyrics saved my life, or your lyrics mean this much to me, or they got me yeah. through a really hard time. I think putting a title like that attached to your lyrics almost is begging people to do that in a way.
Yeah. I mean,
if that makes any sense.
But that's the thing, that title.
Or you're saying, or you're almost pushing that away before it starts.
Well, the title,
either way, right?
The title was a lyric in a song before it was a title.
Yeah. So it doesn't really matter.
Yeah,
you still
yeah, yeah.
You then that even more so something you're enforcing.
Yeah. So the
reinforcing. I mean, something you're reinforcing.
The lyric was originally, it's about my dad, and like we used to write each other letters when. Like, we used to keep it old school. We didn't, like, call or anything like that. We wrote each other letters. And
well, he was away or something?
Yeah, he was, like, not a part of our lives for, like, a chunk of time. And we kept it OG with letters.
Well, why? You said you had the most vanilla, boring childhood ever.
That's just one of those things. It's just one of those things. But that was a lyric that was about him. But then putting it, like you say, putting it as the album title was...
Wow.
Says nothing I write, you can change what you've been through, can apply to other people, and it can be me speaking to the fans, because as much as the lyric was about my dad and to my dad, it translates to other people, because like nothing I write in an album,
I understand it totally,
can change what someone who is reading it and experiencing it has been through.
You just put a spin like that just blew my mind on it, because now yeah. I'm picturing your dad writing you this letter.
Yeah.
And that's what it is. It's not you writing a letter to your dad, it's not you writing a letter to your fans, but now it is.
There you go.
So you've passed it forward, and that's very powerful.
And it's also saying to the fans of the music, like, nothing I write on this album,
totally,
nothing that you relate to is ever going to change all the stuff that you're worried about, but like,
see, that's what I thought it meant, was
yeah.
you making a statement to your fans or to the people listening to the record, not a statement that someone has made to you.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is very, very powerful and very interesting. And I love how passionate you are and how much you care about lyrics. And I know, you know, just the other day you sharing a demo with me about some lyrics and how, you know, a little bit of interband kind of argument, I guess, for you
oh,
know,
yeah.
lack of a better word.
That's how albums are written. Albums are written through arguments.
Right. And the fact that you're very passionate about, like, nope, this is my fucking words and this is what I mean and I want to keep this the way it is,
yeah.
Is very cool and very powerful. And I wish all bands had that sort of, you know, what's the word? Just fuck care, you know? Like,
I don't know. I just there's something about writing lyrics that I just so virulently love and hate, because whilst I'm writing it, I'm always like, oh, this just sounds so wet and so stupid. But at right. the same time, like everything's wet and stupid because you
wet and stupid.
What's the word I'm looking for? You like you ham it up, don't you? You poeticize it, if that's a
yeah,
word.
Yeah.
Like you make it sound
you
nice.
Overdramatize it.
Yeah, but like yeah. it's just to so it like rings nicely, and it doesn't change like the validity of it, because you could say it bluntly, but it just wouldn't really sound as nice. But you can say the exact same thing, but in a more like in a way that flows really well. I think that's what people like. La Dispute. I think the vocalist of La Dispute is a genius. The way he constructs lyrics is incredible. Verse, I think Verse just did it really well.
I love Verse.
Oh, they're so good. Trophy Eyes, I think John Floriani is a really, really good, because he just like, just the way his lyrics read, when you like read them and you're listening to the song, they're just great. And that's the kind of thing that I try and emulate. Like I want it to like read powerfully. A lot of like melodic hardcore bands do it quite well as well. Like Counterparts do it really well. Comeback Kid do it real good.
Andrew's a great lyricist.
It's a couple Canadian boys right there. Right there. My brothers. Cool. How is going to America for the first time and opening up for Newfound Glory? I mean, that is on a 20-year of pop punk tour. Like, first of all, shout out to Paul for getting you on that tour, because that's, wow, that's worth his payment. But how is that? Just obviously a band you've known about it for a long time, to be the only support band for something they're doing that's so, you know, was so huge and crazy.
Yeah.
How was that experience?
That was, like, surreal. Surreal would be a good word. Like, it was something I just never expected. Because Newfound Glory were just, like, this kind of untouchable entity.
Totally.
That existed only on Kerrang. And, you know, they were just, like, the titans. And then to be the only band, oh God, being the only band on that tour was so easy. It was like the easiest tour ever. Like, Loadin was cool. Merch went really well, because like, even if we were getting like pity merch, it was our pity merch. You know?
Well, you had so, the pity merch of like what would have been four bands. It's just you guys.
It was like anyone who was just like, oh, bless the little the young.
Pity merch. I've never heard that expression. That's very funny.
Even if there was people who were like in their mid 30s, I think they don't care about like a new band. They'll just watch and they'll just be like, oh, bless them. We'll buy a shirt just to keep them going. It's like, hell yeah, that's a shirt right there. $20.
Hey, if it looks cool, or you're ripping off the Thrash logo, everyone will love it.
I'm shocked that we haven't been.
You gotta rip off the Thrasher logo. It's gotta happen.
Yeah,
more and more. That's great, man. Well, I know you guys have a big announcement for Slam Dunk 2018.
We just confirmed the
offer,
which
is becoming a very, very big festival over the UK, especially for, you know, your scene.
Absolutely. Slam Dunk is like, I've been going to Slam Dunk coming up on 10 years now.
Wow, it's crazy. Maybe
a little bit less,
but that's existed.
Yeah,
so
like,
cool.
I think, I don't know when the first Slam Dunk was. Because that could be bullshit. But I
feel like we played Slam Dunk like 2009
years ago.
But it was just when we played, it was just Leeds, and I think it started. It was just Leeds, right? And
now you know what? I don't know. Saying 10 years could be me chatting absolute shit, because I should have just said like as long as I can remember. Because like,
it's okay. No one, I don't think they're going to retract the offer and he doesn't know how many years Slam Dunk's been a festival.
I genuinely can just remember going to Slam Dunk like a lot.
Cool.
And I feel like I've been to most Slam Dunks, because they're just, it's the best.
So it's your first time doing it?
No, this will be our third time.
Third time doing it.
Yeah.
But you're probably going to be billed all high, and it's going to be this crazy, crazy
show.
That
would be real cool.
Awesome, awesome. And what else is coming up for you guys?
Well, we're going to write. Like, we get home from this tour in like 4 days, and we are hoping to get to the studio for March-ish. But we have another America tour coming up in January, which, I don't know if I'll get in trouble for saying, I don't know when we're announcing it, but I assume if I can say Slam Dunk, then I can probably say who we're touring with in the US. But I won't.
If you can't, I'll just put a really big bleep over the band name. So who are you touring with?
It's Seaway.
Okay.
We're going out with Seaway in the US. And that's January. So we need to have the album finished before we hit that tour, because we're going straight from that tour into the studio. So we have October, November, December, well, the rest of October, and then November, December to write this album. We've got about 3 or 4 solid songs, but we need to write this album.
Yeah.
And we can. We can definitely do that.
Yeah, I think so.
Because as soon as we get home, we are going to just, like, just kill it. We're going to write every day. I'm going to be writing every day. I'm going to take, like, a few days off to chill, but I'm going to be writing every day. And I need to start watching some, you know, upsetting YouTube videos just to kind of get me in the mood to write some... some sad
well,
letters.
The world's a terrible place
you
right
know what
now.
I mean?
There's lots of things to write about, so you can harness some sadness and some.
I don't like doing social commentary songs, though. I feel
well,
like,
you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be that, because you can take away. Here's the thing: social commentary or political commentary or whatever you want to call
it, changes too quickly.
You can definitely have that stuff trickle down into real personal things.
True.
Like that affect individual people, and sometimes that's something that you can, you know.
But I feel like there's trigger. When it comes to like social commentary lyrics, I feel like there's this really fine line, and on one side of the line is like verse and Rage Against the Machine and like maybe a bit of Rise Against, and on the other side of that line is just like pure garbage. Mm-hmm. And everyone tries so hard, and like every time someone tries to like write the, you know, fuck the system, fuck the world, mm-hmm. it just like 9 times out of 10 it'll fall flat.
And anytime I catch myself thinking like, yeah, I'm going to write like a fuck Donald Trump song, or the banks controlling the world, or like, you know, fuck the Tory government, I just think like, is it going to come off as just a bit like a bit dead? I don't know. I don't really have the...
I know what you mean.
Yeah, I don't really have like the to my core like anti-fascist resistance street level experience to legitimately be writing about that kind of stuff. Like, if I'd have like been living on like the streets of London and had been like involved in all that kind of, like, I could, you know, I involve myself wherever I can, but I'm not like, not like, you know, I don't think it would ring true
right
from me as much as it would from someone who has lived that kind of thing. So I tend to just go for the more like,
I think it's good. I mean, I think you know, people want Toby Duncan to be Toby Duncan. You do you, and are already in a very short time, you've had a great career where you've spoken to a lot of people, and I think sky's the limit for Trash Boat.
I would love
and,
that.
And I look forward to a new record, and all the best with the new year and the new tour with Beep,
Beep,
Seaway,
Beep, Beep, and Beep, Beep. And then second on up, Beep.
Awesome, man. Well, hey, thanks for taking the time, and yeah.
No worries.
Cheers.
Anytime.
There we go. We did it.
Good stuff.
We did it. So there it is with Toby. What an honest guy. I love that he just came right out with everything there. Please go check out Trash Boat's first record. I cannot wait for their second record. They're one of my favorite new bands. They're amazing. They got so much big stuff coming up. And the funny thing, you know, about that Seaway tour is we weren't supposed to announce it. I was supposed to actually, you know, like we joked about, beep it out, because we weren't allowed to announce the tour. But now Seaway's tour has been canceled and Seaway is jumping on the Neck Deep tour. So I don't know what Trash Boat's going to do. So maybe that'll give Toby and the boys a little more time to write that very, very important second album. As always, I will leave you with a tune. Hey, thanks again, everybody, so much for listening to the show. If you like the show, feel free to go on iTunes, write a review. But most of all, tell a friend, tell a loved one. I think word of mouth really is what spreads this thing. I get emails all the time from people just saying, hey, I just found out about this. I know you're at episode like 105, but I just got into your show and I'm telling everybody about it and I'm all about it. And of course, if you want to get in touch, hit me up at leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com. Here is Trash Boat with Strangers, and this one features Soupy himself. So check it out. Here it is on Lead Singer Syndrome. Peace and love. And we'll see you next week.
I won't hold you down.
Like your bedroom.